So thanks so much. And I'm really happy to talk about titration negotiation because it's something that we actually go through all the time in day-to-day practice of psychiatric specialty care. And switching antipsychotics is not just a science, but also an art. And this is what I'm going to get to. When we practice evidence-based medicine, it's not just the science, it's not just the literature, it's also your clinical experience that you've gathered carefully over the years, and it's also the patient's values and preferences. So this requires us to really take a complete look at the patient's clinical status and their history. We're going to talk about when it is appropriate and how to best switch patients from one antipsychotic to another. And I'm going to go over some data, and I'm also going to go over some tips, practical tips. We're going to talk about a specific study that was published about 17 years ago, and it's still quite relevant today, that tells us about switching and when to do it, basically, based on the results of that study. And then we're going to go over some techniques of switching and go over some things to watch out for. So part one is, should I switch or should I stay? And part two is simple, successful switching strategies. I love alliterations, and I got it in part two. Simple, successful switching strategies, of which one is my absolute favorite, and the rest I don't generally do, and I'll point that out. So should I switch or should I stay? There are various questions that go through our mind when we think this through, because switches offer both opportunity for improvement and better tolerability and risk of worsening clinical status and poor tolerability. And we never know. We have a good guess as to what to expect, but you never really know unless you try. So the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, so to speak. A medication doesn't have to be perfect. Nothing is perfect in this world. But it has to relieve symptoms well enough, be tolerated well enough, and the patient has to want to take it. So we're going to use shared decision making. We're going to use motivational interviewing. If we had time, we would have sessions on shared decision making and motivational interviewing where we can go over this in detail. But there are other lectures, other conferences where this has gone over in a way that would be helpful. And I urge you to seek them out, seek those lectures out. Because we need to get buy-in from our patients in order to promote adherence. And the only way to do that is by meeting them where they are, understanding their degree of ambivalence to change, and then make it so that they come up with this decision. Individuals have their own preferences and values regarding what's important to them in terms of what symptoms to treat and what side effects to avoid. Not everyone's going to want the same degree of efficacy, for example, for all their symptoms in quite the same way. Some people want to sleep better more than anything else. Other people want to concentrate better than anything else. And other people want their mood regulated by more than anything else. And you never really know until you start exploring these issues with your individual patients. And then we know that some patients don't want to gain an ounce, and others don't mind if they gain 5, 10, 15 pounds as long as they feel better. Some patients don't want to feel at all tired during the day. Others, you know, that's not the end of the world for them. So we don't know unless we ask our patients about their prior experiences with medicines, and when we talk about what we're going to try, talk about what to generally expect. So details do matter. The past history of response certainly matters. The level of acuity certainly matters. You know, we're not going to go for a medicine that we have to titrate slowly over the course of a month to treat someone who has bipolar depression with something that's off-label, begins with the letter L, and ends with INE, and it's called lamotrigine. We don't do that because it takes so long to titrate to something that would work, even though we're tempted to do that. And so we'll reach for something that works faster in someone who needs acute relief of symptoms. We're going to think about patient preference and their history of adherence. If they have a history of really poor adherence, no matter what, we're going to think about long-acting injectables, as we discussed about in some manner yesterday during the Jeopardy game. The need for special monitoring. Well, some patients can't do that. So this is often stymies us when we want to offer clozapine, for example. They have to be amenable to other things if we're going to prescribe drugs that require other things. So that too is a consideration. So how we choose is really going to depend on evidence-based practice, which is actually patient-centered care, patient-centered therapy. Your clinical judgment, the relevant scientific evidence, and then the patient's values and preferences. So your brain, your patient's brain, and keeping up with the literature and making sense of it. Obviously not a cookbook. Now, who recognizes this fellow here? One or two hands. Okay, I threw this in. It's a bit of popular culture. It's from the Twilight Zone. It's from the episode To Serve Man, one of my favorite episodes. And it's not a cookbook, To Serve Man, by the way. Or it is a cookbook. Effectiveness, all-cause discontinuation. That's the title of this slide, and this is one of the most important slides I'm going to show you. Effectiveness is how well something works in the real world. And a great definition is all-cause discontinuation to measure if something works in the real world. Why would that be? Well, if someone stops a medicine, it means didn't work, wasn't tolerated, they don't want to take it. Hey, that's not the medicine for them. So effectiveness can be measured by all-cause discontinuation and is driven by efficacy. Does the medicine reduce symptoms? It's driven by tolerability and safety. Does the medicine cause side effects? And it's driven by adherence and persistence. Will the patient take the medicine? You need all three ingredients to have something that actually works. Treatment effectiveness in the real world. And when you measure all-cause discontinuation, it's an integration of these three factors. Now, is there evidence to support using all-cause discontinuation as a measure of effectiveness? And does it really help us distinguish amongst the antipsychotics? Well, let's look for evidence here. And there is a randomized clinical trial that tested switches from one antipsychotic to another that enrolled 1,500 people with schizophrenia, that looked at several second-generation antipsychotics, that included a first-generation antipsychotic, that allowed people with alcohol and substance use problems to be enrolled. How many trials can you think that actually enrolls patients with substance use problems? Not many. This study also allowed people with comorbid medical conditions and comorbid medications. It was geared towards outpatients. Hey, this looked ideal to answer the question for me as an outpatient psychiatrist, which antipsychotic should I use? What happens if I switch an antipsychotic under different situations, different scenarios? And, you know, I'm interested in treatment effectiveness and how long someone stays on their medicine. I'm also interested in tolerability outcomes, too. This study tells us all of this. Katie. Who remembers Katie? Yes, many of us remember Katie. We all paid for Katie. $41 million, tax dollars paid for Katie, was funded by the NIMH. It answered the question, should I switch to olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, ziprasidone, or clozapine? Back in the day, around the year 2000, 2001, 2002, these were the questions at hand. Katie was an effectiveness study that tested switches to a variety of different antipsychotics, and if that didn't work out, they could be switched again. And if that didn't work out, they can be switched again. It's kind of like the STAR-D study for schizophrenia. Those studies were all done in the same era. At that time, the NIMH was very interested in clinical trial work to help explain how best to treat patients in the real world. Now, not so much. But back then, they were, and they funded these large studies. Katie was the schizophrenia study of interest here. And you know what? Katie generated lots of papers. Last time I looked in January of this year, there were close to 100 different papers, studies, that have mined the Katie database, including the principal paper, the phase 2 paper, the phase 3 papers, and all of that, plus all the sub-analyses and post hoc work done with Katie. So effectiveness, as measured by all-cause discontinuation, It's a very helpful way to look at an outcome that is of interest to us. It's recognized as an index for effectiveness. Stopping a medicine, you stop it for a reason. It reflects both the physician and the patient, or healthcare provider and the patient, evaluation of the treatment outcome. It incorporates various domains of tolerability and efficacy. We can dig down and take a look at that. Has economic and clinical relevance, both. So someone's on a medicine, that costs money. Someone's not on a medicine, well, that costs less money, right? Because you don't have to pay for the medicine, but there are some consequences in terms of hospitalization and other healthcare costs. And it's easy to measure. You're either on the medicine or you're not. So the CATIE trial design was all about phases of treatment, or steps, if you want to call them. Phase one, phase two, phase three. Phase one, the initial randomization to olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, ziprasidone, or perphenazine. That was the prototypical first-generation antipsychotic that was selected for this study, where patients, if they were randomized to one of these, the double-blind, randomized, they could remain on it for up to 18 months. That was the idea. 1,500 people were randomized. But if for any reason they stopped their initially randomized medicine, they were offered to be re-randomized to something else. And they knew it going into the study. They knew that they would get first a medicine, and if they didn't like it, and if it didn't work out, they can get something else. Well, that's clinical practice, folks. People get something, and you tell them if it doesn't work, they can get something else. This study actually used that as a paradigm. Phase two had two parts to it. There was one part where people could possibly get clozapine, and that was called the efficacy pathway. And then there was another part of phase two where you would otherwise not get clozapine, that wasn't an option, but you could possibly get ziprasidone. Ziprasidone was brand new at the time, and it was considered possibly, hey, this is our holy grail for a tolerable drug. We didn't know much at the time about ziprasidone, but we thought because it wasn't associated with weight gain that it would be really a big deal. So patients and their carers could choose basically between the clozapine pathway or the ziprasidone pathway. So that was up to them. But if that didn't work out, there was always phase three. Phase three was open label and allowed combinations, allowed LAIs, and allowed this brand new drug that just came out in the middle of the study called aripiprazole. Now there were some sub-phases and other ways of looking at switches that I'll go over, that one of them is particularly important. So it was a complicated study. I grant you that. Phase one, phase two, phase three, that's pretty complicated. At the bottom, you'll see in green, phase 1A. What is that? Well, phase 1A, participants who did not, who had tardive dyskinesia could not get perphenazine. You may wonder why. Well, TD was thought at the time to be pretty much caused by first-generation antipsychotics, and it was thought that second-generation antipsychotics wouldn't be so risky. Well, of course, we were wrong. You can get TD with second-generation antipsychotics, too, but it was considered at the time that it was really a big deal here, this difference. So anyone with TD could not get perphenazine for ethical reasons. But they still had to go through a phase one of sorts, and that was called phase 1A. And so they didn't get randomized to perphenazine. And then there was a phase 1B. What about people who failed perphenazine in phase one? How do we deal with them? Because they couldn't really go on to phase two directly. They had to go through another step. And that was re-randomization to olanzapine, quetiapine, or risperidone before going on to phase two. So perphenazine complicated things. It added an element of, you know, what do we do with people with TD because we can't give them perphenazine? What do we do if you're randomized to perphenazine and you failed it? You can't go right into phase two. You had to go through a process where you were exposed to a second generation antipsychotic. This will all make sense to you in a couple of slides from now. The implications of having phases is that this is a switch study. Yes, Katy is one of our largest switch studies we have ever encountered in the clinical literature. Patients, when they're enrolled, they're told that switches will be possible. Time to switch is the primary outcome measure, not time to failure, time to switch. Switch implies medicine didn't work well enough, wasn't tolerated well enough, or the patient didn't want to take it. And the paradigm is an expectation of a benefit. And if you don't have a benefit of any kind, you switch. This is exactly what we do in clinical practice. That's why I love Katy. And I remember 15 years ago talking a lot about Katy, extolling her virtues, so to speak. I'm personifying Katy now. And it was very helpful in thinking through our choices at the time. Mind you, today we have additional choices, so that's a limitation. Let's get started. Here are the phase one effectiveness data. Any questions? Here's the rub. It is difficult to interpret the Katy data just looking at the article as published. So we need to take another look in another way. And I want to look at phase one first. Patients were randomized to olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, ziprasidone, or profenazine, and they can receive it for up to 18 months. The doses were, pretty much run-of-the-mill, with the exception of olanzapine, where you can go over the recommended maximum of 20. At the time, we thought that was a good idea. And here are the results. All-cause discontinuation for all the patients was 74%. That means only one out of four remained on their medicine for the entire 18 months. And at first you would say, oh my God, only one out of four remained on their medicine for the entire duration of the study. Our medicines aren't so great. Think this through. If you picked a medicine out of a hat and gave it to your next patient with schizophrenia, what do you think the chances of them being on that medicine 18 months later? One out of four? You're doing real well. So this actually was pretty good. And when we look at the reasons for discontinuation, it's patient decision. 30% patient decision discontinuation rate. 30%. One out of three. This is the reason patients stop their medicine. They really can't articulate why. They just don't want to take it. And when you look at the next most common reason, lack of efficacy, that's driven by us. When you look at the third reason, the least common reason is intolerability. This is what you answered in the pre-test as the most common reason. It's not. It's the least. Patients value efficacy over tolerability. And that's quite remarkable. When you think through this, this actually is true. We have many patients in our practices that have side effects that would be bothersome for some, but not for that individual who would rather live with that side effect than live with the symptoms. I think we see that here in Katy. When we take a look at the different adverse events and tolerability issues that led to discontinuation, it's all over the map. Weight gain is only part of it. Good old extrapyramidal effects, movement problems, is equivalent as reasons to stop. Sedation is up there. Other is the miscellaneous category, or maybe a mixture of things. Well, that's really eye-opening. When we take a look for the different choices that they were randomized to, olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, profenazine, or ziprasidone, we'll find that the majority discontinued regardless of the medicine, but some discontinued more often than others. And when we compare these discontinuation rates drug to drug, we can do something like calculate number needed to treat. How many patients needed to be randomized to one versus the other before expecting one to be able to remain for 18 months on that medicine in this study. And that will include consideration of efficacy, patient decision, and tolerability. The whole shebang is included in this discontinuation rate metric. Let's take a look. All-cause discontinuation and number needed to treat. Olanzapine compared to quetiapine revealed a number needed to treat of 6, which meant for every 6 patients randomized to olanzapine instead of quetiapine, you encountered 1 additional patient who remained in the study for the entire 18 months on that drug. Olanzapine was clearly superior to quetiapine on this measure. It was also superior to profenazine and ziprasidone with a single-digit number needed to treat value. Rule of thumb, NNT value less than 10, this is going to be apparent in your day-to-day clinical practice. So under randomized double-blind conditions, people randomized to olanzapine instead of quetiapine, profenazine, or ziprasidone remained on their drug for the entire 18 months of the study in a very palpable manner. You will notice this, and we have noticed it. We did know for years olanzapine seemed to be a better drug. Compared to risperidone, it barely missed that threshold of an NNT of 10. Here the NNT was 11. So arguably you can say it's going to take a little bit more observation to detect a difference between olanzapine and risperidone. But still, statistically speaking, it beat risperidone. Now, why did olanzapine perform so well? Here's the percentage who discontinued because of efficacy. It was the lowest for olanzapine. It was almost double for quetiapine. It was higher for the others. Lowest rate of discontinuation because of lack of efficacy, 15%. That's it. That's why it was the big winner. Lower percent patients hospitalized for exacerbation, 11%. Hospitalized for exacerbation compared to 20% for those on quetiapine. So 1 out of 10 for those on olanzapine, 1 out of 5 for those on quetiapine. Which one would you rather select to keep someone out of the hospital? Risperidone, profenazine, ziprasidone also did not perform as well as olanzapine, but did perform better than quetiapine. So quetiapine didn't look so good in phase 1. In this respect. Now here are the percent of patients who discontinued because of intolerability. And yes, it's true. More patients discontinued olanzapine because of intolerability than the other medicines. But what overrode that was the efficacy, which was so strong and stronger than any tolerability consideration. Risperidone, by the way, was fairly well tolerated. Only 1 out of 10 discontinued because of a tolerability issue. When we look at weight and metabolic outcomes, yes, it's true that patients randomized to olanzapine had a higher rate of discontinuation because of weight or metabolic outcomes, almost 1 out of 10. But you know, that was overridden by its superiority in terms of efficacy, which drove all the results in this study in terms of all-cause discontinuation. I promised to show you a bit about that oddball phase, phase 1b. It adds a twist to the story. Remember that patients who had failed profenazine could not go directly to phase 2. It had to go through phase 1b, where they were randomized to olanzapine, quetiapine, or risperidone. And if they failed one of those, then they can go on to phase 2. Now, why do that? Phase 2 was designed to answer the question, if you failed a second-generation antipsychotic, what do you do? Now, profenazine is not a second-generation antipsychotic. So you had to have this phase 1b to be able to feed patients into phase 2 that were truly met the criteria of you had to have failed a second-generation antipsychotic. Profenazine is tightly bound to the dopamine D2 receptor. Profenazine is, you know, different than some of the other second-generation antipsychotics that are loosely bound. And this comes into play in the results of phase 1b. Because look here, quetiapine didn't look so bad. Quetiapine really did not perform well at all in regular phase 1, and yet it was superior to risperidone in phase 1b. So was olanzapine. So the NNTs here are 4 and 5. They're actually quite powerful NNT numbers. For every four patients randomized to quetiapine versus risperidone in phase 1b, you had one additional patient who remained on quetiapine for the duration of the study. Quetiapine was the big winner. Risperidone was not. And risperidone performed so well in relatively speaking, second best to olanzapine in regular phase 1. What happened? Well, patients failed perphenazine. If you fail perphenazine, would you give something that kind of looks like perphenazine in terms of receptor binding profile to the D2 receptor? Probably not. And risperidone, particularly at the higher doses, we've all learned over the years that it looks more like a first-generation antipsychotic. So we've learned to dose lower. So it's a different animal than quetiapine, which we learned is loosely bound, or olanzapine, which is more loosely bound than risperidone. Interesting stuff, and it turned the world on its head here in terms of how we think about the different second-generation antipsychotics, but phase 1 is not the end. It's not the end of the study. Patients were informed that they could be switched to something else. And I want to emphasize a point here. This last bullet point should be eye-opening. Although 3/4 of KD patients stopped their phase 1 medication prior to 18 months, almost 2/3 continued to be followed after re-randomization. And nearly half of the patients who enrolled finished the full amount of follow-up. This was a highly successful study. So even though at first you don't succeed, you try and try again. We learned this in STAR-D for treating patients with major depressive disorder. We learned that after step 1, certain percentage have responded, but those who didn't, you go on to step 2 and switch or augment. And if they didn't get response or remission, you go on to step 3. And then if that didn't work out, you go on to step 4. That's what we do in clinical practice. We eventually find something that works. So that's why I like KD so much. It goes through switches. So there were two phase 2 pathways, the clozapine pathway and the ziprasidone pathway. Most people entered the tolerability or ziprasidone pathway because the efficacy pathway included clozapine. And not everyone agreed to be potentially randomized to clozapine. This was the only open label part of KD in phase 2. If you were assigned to clozapine, you knew it. You got your blood draws every week and so on, and not everyone wanted to get that going in. So they were shunted towards the tolerability pathway, probably inappropriately. But this is real life. We do that all the time. Phase 2. So here is the phase 2 efficacy pathway, the clozapine pathway, and discontinuation due to all cause. Clearly, clozapine is the winner over quetiapine and risperidone, NNTs of 3 or 4. For every 3 patients randomized to clozapine instead of quetiapine, you had someone remaining in the study on clozapine. Okay, that's a really powerful number needed to treat value. You'll notice that there is no little bars on top of the olanzapine. That's because there were only about 100 people in this phase, in this part of KD, and it did not reach statistical significance. But if you calculated the NNT, that too was, looked not bad. It just wasn't statistically significant, and so I don't show it to you here. The ziprasidone pathway, the big winner wasn't ziprasidone, and it wasn't quetiapine. It was olanzapine and risperidone, curiously enough, probably because the people who got into the tolerability pathway also included people who did not respond adequately to their medicine in phase 1. So it also included poor responders. However, ziprasidone demonstrated an advantage here that was quite clear. What about those people who gained at least 7% of their body weight in phase 1? What are the chances of losing 7% or more of your body weight in phase 2? Well, it was much better with ziprasidone than it was with olanzapine. No one who was randomized to olanzapine who had gained 7% or more of their weight in phase 1 on something else, they didn't lose any weight if they were randomized to olanzapine. That did not happen. But if you were randomized to ziprasidone, it happened 42% of the time. an NNT of 3 compared to olanzapine. For every 3 patients randomized to ziprasidone versus olanzapine, you would encounter one additional patient who will lose more than 7% of their body weight that they had gained. Well, we learned that about ziprasidone. It was the drug we switched to if we wanted to see some weight loss. We wouldn't switch them to olanzapine to see them lose weight, right? Right? Okay. Before applying these learnings from Katie, we have to ask ourselves, am I treating someone similar? Are they ambulatory? Are they non-treatment refractory? Make sure they're not schizoaffective, because they were not included in Katie. You couldn't be schizoaffective and be in Katie. You also couldn't be in your first episode and be in Katie. So that's a whole different animal, so to speak. Is treatment consistent with my patient's values and preferences? Well, it doesn't matter if you recommend something that the patient absolutely doesn't want. And is the treatment feasible in your practice setting? Is it on the formulary? What does it cost? Now, none of these medicines that I talked about in Katie, cost is an issue anymore. They're all generic. But they are an issue for the newer medicines. In phase 1, Katie tells us that olanzapine had clear advantages in terms of all-cause discontinuation and efficacy, but switches still offer both opportunity and risk. Where you end depends on where you start. So besides the olanzapine outcome, what else do we know? Well, if patients fail a tight D2 binding agent, phase 1b tells us quetiapine may actually be reasonable. Even though phase 1 tells us, no, I don't think quetiapine did well at all, phase 1b, quetiapine did reasonably well, because they already went through a process of demonstrating failure to a tight D2 blocking agent. So I would go towards something that looks a little different to the patient's brain, something that's more loosely bound to D2 receptors. So that's part of the art of psychopharmacology, based on the science of psychopharmacology. Did the patient fail phase 1 because of efficacy? Well, then you'll think about clozapine. Did they fail because of tolerability? You wouldn't necessarily go to ziprasidone unless it's weight that you're concerned about. Otherwise, risperidone didn't look so bad there. And that probably explains why risperidone is still the most commonly prescribed antipsychotic for patients with schizophrenia today. That, and it costs nothing. Is weight gain greater than 7% the predominant concern is still with us today? And we reach for alternatives that we hope will work better, that will still maintain efficacy. So what about azacitidine, lurasidone, brexpiprazole, cariprazine, lumateperone, and olanzapine-samidorphan combination? Katie doesn't tell us anything about that, so we have to incorporate this new evidence in some manner through some other studies, and perhaps indirect comparisons, meta-analyses are quite helpful here. What about oral aripiprazole? Well, that was only in phase 3 of Katie, so we don't have much information there. How about LAIs? Well, they weren't included in Katie except for open label in phase 3, so we have to look for other sources of information there. What about transdermals? Well, they're brand new for us. We only have one currently, a acetamipine transdermal system, and that'll fit somewhere in terms of patients' values and preferences. We just have to find where. What about schizoaffective disorder? Well, we're still lacking in clinical data helping us make decisions there. We can't really depend on the indication that's approved by the FDA, because very few companies actually do those studies to get their drug approved for that purpose. What about first episode psychosis? That's a good question too. I'll answer some of these the best I can in my next presentation, which is towards the end of the day, called Make New Friends But Keep the Old, Optimizing Antipsychotic Treatments for Schizophrenia. So I hope to see you there at the end of the day. Now in the next 9 minutes, I'm gonna cover part 2. And you're probably gonna wonder, how is he gonna do this in 9 minutes? Very quickly. Many of these slides are very busy. I warn you in advance. They're not intended for me to go over them point by point with you. I'm going to go over the highlights. They should serve as a reference for you. I've gathered tables from papers that are handy to have So if you want to print them out on your printer, even though I don't like paper, these are the kinds of things that paper is useful for charts and tables that are handy to take a look at when you need a refresher for your memory. So there are several strategies that are on our minds. How to switch? Should I abruptly stop or start? Should I abruptly start the new, titrate the old? Start the new slowly, titrate down slowly? I mean, there's so many variations. But we have to consider what would be the optimal approach to prevent tolerability issues and to preserve efficacy as best we can. In order to do that, we have to understand the pharmacodynamic profile, that is, which receptors do these drugs hit? And we have to also understand the pharmacokinetic profile, half-life. And keep in mind, no matter how carefully you design a switching strategy, patients will do what they like. And they may stop their old medicine abruptly because my doctor is switching my medicine. I just want to stop it. I'll just stop it. And they do. And they won't necessarily tell you either. And they may not even tell you about their side effects that they're experiencing either. You have to really have a conversation about this and try to make sure that they know that you're not doing this arbitrarily and you're not recommending this to them arbitrarily, but you want to minimize the chance of rebound phenomena, rebound side effects and tolerability issues. You don't want them to complain of poor sleep all of a sudden or GI distress all of a sudden, or, you know, feeling out of sorts all of a sudden, or having abnormal movements all of a sudden. You'll encounter, and I'm going to spend 1 minute on this, studies done by pharmaceutical companies when a drug is first approved, and, you know, 1 or 2 years later, they come out with a switch study, where they tell you that there are several ways to switch to this new drug. And we tested them in a randomized controlled manner. And the bottom line for all of these studies, I'm not even going to read the slide, I'm just going to tell you the bottom line. For every single one of these studies, what was found was that it didn't matter how you switched the patient. You can immediately start and discontinue the old medicine. You could taper off the old medicine. You can up-titrate the new medicine. You can do any variation whatsoever, and it doesn't matter. Everyone gets better. Well, that's very reassuring. Just go ahead and do whatever the hell you want, and patients will get better. That's the message. But, you know, these studies are flawed. So there's one for aripiprazole, there was one for iloperidone, and there's one for lurasidone, and basically telling us it doesn't matter how you do it, just do it, and patients will get better. Now, this is actually not inaccurate in terms of the interpretation of the results of the study, but it completely ignores the fact that individuals are individuals. They will react differently to what you recommend and what they do. And then when you start having large groups of patients, all this gets lost. And the differences between individuals becomes homogenized. And you end up not showing any differences between any switching strategies, because you can't. Because the individual variation is so great, and then it all like blends in into like the same outcomes when you compare groups. You can't study switches like that the way it's been done. So don't let that discourage you, because we can do better than what the studies have told us, you know, that everything works the same, because we know it doesn't. We'll consider the underlying pharmacodynamic profile, the receptor binding affinities, and the underlying pharmacokinetic profile, the half-life, and we'll individualize our decision-making. Now, sometimes our hands are forced. An absolute neutrophil count goes down to very low. We have to stop the clozapine. That's abrupt discontinuation. We have no choice. But that's about the only situation where it's no choice. Otherwise, we can recommend things in a much more reasonable fashion. We're going to do first steps, get a good baseline assessment, cognitive assessment, make sure you got all your ducks in a row in terms of all your labs, and then we'll use the dose of the current medication to target the dose for the new medication. If they need high doses of stuff, they may need high doses of the new stuff. I mean, that's like common sense. and there are many strategies. There are more strategies than yoga positions. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to this long list. I would just go over three basic strategies. Abrupt discontinuation, well, you know, it's simple, easy to understand, easy for us to write, but you may have symptom exacerbation and possible withdrawal reactions. So you run the risk of someone all of a sudden having more symptoms and then withdrawing from the prior drug and having side effects there, and you don't do it. So don't do this if you don't have to. You may have to with clozapine, and patients may end up doing this, but don't do this if you don't have to. Cross-tapering sounds attractive until you reach that point where you're not on enough of anything, and then you possibly will get breakthrough psychosis. So I don't do this either unless I'm pretty confident that they were on too high a dose anyway. Delayed withdrawal, I think, is my favorite here because I don't want to have a relapse of symptoms. I really don't. And I tell patients that we're going to do it the safe way. I'm going to start your new medicine now and keep the old as much as I can. And then once you're on the right dose, the dose that you're going to be on the new drug, we'll start decreasing the old medicine. Lots of patients like this, but I warn them, you might get some more side effects during that time when you're on maybe too much of the antipsychotic. So I warn them, and don't do this. Who remembers this robot? Yeah, danger, Will Robinson. Don't do this. Avoid stopping the old drug. Okay, you're on nothing now. Let's, you know, gradually start up your new drug. That's just too dangerous. You're going to end up with an acutely exacerbated patient too often. Now, here's one of the tables I want to provide a guidance to. Each receptor has a different effect in when you block it. And when you unblock it, you may get a withdrawal or rebound effect. And it varies. Don't start memorizing it now. Here are the receptor binding profiles in Ki units and nanomolars. Don't memorize this now. In fact, never memorize this. Keep it handy if you need a refresher. Switching from high D2 affinity agents to low D2 affinity agents can be a problem with withdrawal dyskinesias. So you slow down the down titration rate. You warn patients about this. That's my strategy there. How about high anticholinergic activity to low anticholinergic activity? Slow the down titration. You'll see a theme here. Slow the down titration. Switching from a sedative agent to a non-sedative agent. Slow the down titration. Augment with a benzo if you have to. We learned this with ziprasidone. Give a benzo when you start switching to ziprasidone. You'll probably be more successful when they come off the quetiapine, for example. So slow down the down titration when you're switching from unlike drug. How long half-lives means it takes longer to reach steady state. You may be surprised with side effects that present themselves later on, and you have to be more patient. But on the other hand, it's somewhat easier to cross-titrate from these drugs because they linger for longer. So it has a built-in down titration, so to speak. So that's not bad. Missing doses of something with a very long half-life is also not the end of the world. But you can't stop a long half-life drug and expect the effects to immediately dissipate. So that's the downside, but that's also an upside. How do we know about half-lives? Well, we have to refer to tables. Here's one, don't memorize this, and the principal liver enzyme, don't memorize this, but this will drive to some degree the half-life. So I want to leave you with a couple of pointers here towards the end, and I know we're running out of time, and it's going to take away some time for questions. I'm going to make myself available throughout the day if you have additional questions, and my presentation this afternoon, at the end of the afternoon, actually has built in more some additional time too. Cariprazine has a very long half-life, And I want to emphasize this because it's the only one that has this long half-life, an oral drug where its principal active metabolite half-life is 2 to 3 weeks. 2 to 3 weeks. So at steady state, this main active metabolite, affectionately called DDCAR, didesmethylcariprazine, is the predominant circulating active moiety. It's a fancy term to mean that coursing through the person's bloodstream is this active ingredient, DDCAR, that is responsible for keeping them well. Not cariprazine. Cariprazine is what's taken every day, but it's the DDCAR eventually that is responsible for keeping that person well at steady state. 70% of the total exposure, that is all the active stuff in the person's blood, is going to be DDCAR, half-life of 2 to 3 weeks. So understanding undesirable rebound effects is going to be key during the initial switch period. And you really don't have to memorize this either. If you do the slow down titration of whatever they were on before, you will take care of most of these issues. If you consider a benzo when you need to someone who is having some problems sleeping, you will manage that too. Too abrupt switching will be a problem, so don't do that. That's what these first three bullet points mention. It also goes through the Doan's to Peen's and to the PIPs. You've all heard this before in prior presentations from Dr. Stahl, and it's also in his book. But let me just summarize the slide for you. You don't have to read these tips. If you just remember that I'm going to down titrate the prior drug slowly and avoid most of these problems. I'll be especially careful when going from one kind of SGA to another kind of SGA. So a Doan to a Doan is easier than a Doan to a Peen or the other way around. But you can really avoid all that. Slow down titration of the prior drug when you can, and you're going to stay out of trouble. There are several reasons to consider switching antipsychotics. They could be efficacy for your individual patient. They could be tolerability. They could be, you know, some reason that they can't actually articulate. There's so much heterogeneity in terms of efficacy and tolerability that it's wonderful to have actually medicines to try for individual patients. Trying to find the right key to the right lock is how I explain it to patients. If you have information about prior response and prior tolerability, Katie tells us that that's actually very helpful information. And we can sort of steer our patients towards choices that are optimized. And although switching strategies, there are a gazillion of them, I gave you a list of 9. There are actually many more. There's only one that I use 90% of the time. Down titrate the old one once you know where you are with the new one. So the delayed withdrawal method, where someone is on their medicine, you're concerned about stopping it too abruptly, you're going to start the new one. When you get to the dose of the new one that you feel okay with, the patient feels okay with, then go down on the old one. Now, sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes people just want to stop. So warn them about the things that can happen. Go back to the tables, see what side effects are relevant for that drug, and then you've informed the patient, they know what to expect.